From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
Broadway actually was much more open to Spanish people than the rest of the culture was for many, many years.
Today, we embark on a trip through the history of Latinos on Broadway.
It was the first time where I wasn't the token Latino in the room. It was a piece about Latinos written by a Latino. And so there was an authenticity there that I had not experienced before.
Also, 1 year after Hurricane Maria, we look into the storm's repercussions for Puerto Rico.
The federal response was never as strong or as quick as it should have been. And there were warnings. There were early indications.
Plus, we speak with the wives of the two drug traffickers set to testify against El Chapo. All this coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No te vayas. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. This year, Lin-Manuel Miranda's breakout musical In the Heights turns 10 years old. Our producer, Ginny Montalvo, is a huge fan, as am I. And she, along with our producer, Antonia Cerejido, are going to kick off this week's show with a little journey through the history of Latinos on Broadway. It's part of a segment we call The Breakdown, where Antonia takes Latino cultural phenomena and takes us down the rabbit hole. Today with producer Ginny Montalvo.
Oh, happy day.
No, talk normal. Literally, just say a sentence.
It's Ginny, and I'd like to mention I'm on the microphone this morning. Honk your horn if you're on it. Antonia, we are taking a trip down Broadway today.
Like we're walking there?
No, like Broadway musicals, Antonia. Because my favorite musical, In the Heights, written by Lin-Manuel Miranda, turned 10 this year.
Ooh, many know him from Hamilton, but he was a big deal before then.
Did you see it on
Broadway?
I actually
haven't seen In the Heights.
No, I just got chills.
I'm sorry.
I have seen it enough for both of us.
Okay, cool.
How about that?
Yeah, I have a question.
Yes.
Do you have every word of In the Heights memorized?
Yes.
Every single word?
Probably.
I mean, like, could you perform the entire play right now?
Lights up on Washington Heights. Up at the break of day, I wake up and I got this little punk I gotta chase away.
Pop the great, get the crack of dawn, sing.
Oh my God. Okay. My name's not a snobby. But anyways.
Now I'm ready to hear about In the Heights.
Okay.
I am snobby and you probably never heard my name.
Reports okay, so do you at least know what In the Heights is about?
No, I know that it's in the Heights, Washington Heights, which is actually really close to where our offices are, but I have no idea what, like, the plot of the musical is. So what is it?
All right, so I'm going to give you a little background here. Ready?
Nice, yeah.
All right, In the Heights is a story of a Dominican guy in Upper Manhattan who runs a bodega. But he's always kind of questioned where is home, right? Is it in the Dominican Republic or is it here in New York City? So I saw In the Heights for the first time in April of 2008. It opened in March of 2008.
Okay.
And I walk out of there and my mind is blown. And I call my parents who live in Atlanta and I'm like, you have to come to New York. You have to see this show because they're Dominican. And then I took every person, family member, friend that was visiting. So 10 years later, I'm looking back at In the Heights, and while I know why it was important to me personally, I am now realizing that it's actually important to a lot of people. And it was important to the trajectory of Latinos on Broadway.
Right.
Because if you think of, like, what are the big musicals that had kind of a Latino story, you have
West Side Story.
And In the Heights.
So West Side Story is a love story.
Yeah, it's two star-crossed lovers, a Puerto Rican girl and a white guy set against two dueling gangs on the streets of New York in the 50s. It's basically Romeo and Juliet.
Right.
You have seen that, right?
Yeah, of course. I've seen West Side Story like a million times.
Okay, good, good, good. West Side Story was the first time that a Broadway show was about Latinos. But it wasn't a positive Latino story. It was about gangs. And as far as I really know, that was
it in terms of Latino representation in this major American media.
But Antonia, I want to take you behind the curtain because there's actually a bigger history of Latinos on Broadway, and that's what we're going to talk about today.
Oh my God, I'm excited. I know nothing about any of that history.
Neither did I.
Okay.
Okay, Anto, meet Robert.
Hi, my name is Robert Viagas. I spent 20 years as founding managing editor of Playbill.com, and I'm now full-time author.
He knows everything there is to know about the theater, and actually specifically Latinos on Broadway.
Broadway actually was much more open to Spanish people than the rest of the culture was for many, many years. A lot of people who came from Spanish countries originated on the stage in vaudeville on Broadway.
I'm just going to jump in here and say that when Robert says Spanish people, he's using the term the way it was used in the early theater days, meaning back then, anyone coming from any country that spoke Spanish was called Spanish.
Before there was the web, before there was television, before there was even radio, there was an entertainment form called vaudeville. The way people would go and be entertained was to go to theaters. A lot of the theaters that are now movie theaters were originally vaudeville theaters. And they would have a bill of sometimes 8 to 12 acts.
So kind of like a variety show.
It was a variety show.
So surprisingly, there were Latinos on stage during the vaudeville era. But Robert says they were stuck playing mostly stereotypes of themselves.
But what we associate with Broadway really came about at the beginning of the 20th century.
And those stereotypes basically got passed on to early Broadway. We see a lot of them pop up in the early 1900s.
The sense of humor has completely inverted in the past 100 years. In those days, if you said something sexual, you could lose your career. However, doing ethnic humor was very popular. There were a lot of, especially in New York, there were a lot of different ethnic groups that were all coming together at the same time. And having these stereotypes was kind of like a Cliff Notes way of getting to know various people.
These ethnic stereotypes were surface level. They weren't real people. They were to make people laugh.
A lot of people that you associate with film, like Lupe Velez, she actually started on Broadway. She was in a show produced by Ziegfeld called Hot Cha.
I just want to be Conchita without a true love.
Called what?
Hot Cha.
Even Carmen Miranda, we associate with the films, with her big hat full of fruit. She actually also started on Broadway in 1939 in a play called The Streets of Paris.
Ay, 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 é o canto do pregoneiro, salsa americano.
Cole Porter wrote a show called Mexican Hayride. Rodgers and Hart wrote a show called Too Many Girls in 1939. Desi Arnaz was the star of Too Many Girls, and he had a song with a great title, She Could Shake the Maracas.
She could shake her maracas. He could play the guitar.
I'm so slow. I just picked up on what the maracas meant. So how does West Side Story get made in this time where Latinos are essentially a punchline?
Well, I'm going to tell you. In the 1950s, this theater power team, Stephen Sondheim, Leonard Bernstein, Arthur Lawrence, and Jerome Robbins, decide they want to do this modern take on Romeo and Juliet. Originally, their plan was to do a Catholic-Jewish conflict, but the 1922 musical Abby's Irish Rose did that, so they started to look for something else. And they're reading the papers, they're seeing gang violence, and they're like, this is our ticket. This is what's going to drive this show.
And when they were reading the papers, they were reading specifically about Puerto Rican gangs?
There were a lot of youth gangs of different ethnicities in the 50s. But Puerto Ricans were in the news a lot because after World War II, New York saw the largest number of Puerto Ricans coming to the city. The number of Puerto Ricans from 1940 to 1970 increased by more than 10 times. So Broadway's a New York City thing, right? So including Puerto Ricans made sense because it was a reflection of New York City at the time. Anyway, the creators come up with this idea for West Side Story, but as they start pitching it around, they keep getting rejected.
Do you know why they were getting rejected?
I do. This is Leonard Bernstein, the composer, from an audio documentary NPR made when West Side Story turned 50.
They said no. They said there's nothing in it anybody can sing. It's too depressing. It's too advanced. It's too crazy. There are too many words in the lyrics. Nobody can remember them. The intervals, it's too rangy. Who can sing Maria? Nobody can sing notes like that. I just read it. Impossible.
Maria, I've just met a girl named Maria.
So they had no problem with the Puerto Rican storyline.
Which is funny, because that's what you would think, right? Yeah. In the 50s, like...
They just thought Maria was too hard of a song.
Maria, I've just...
They had a lot of trouble, but finally they did get a producer, Hal Prince, who was a friend of Stephen Sondheim's. And so it opens on September 26th of 1957.
Was it a hit right away?
Well, let me read you some of the reviews. Here's what the New York Daily News had to say about opening night. West Side Story, a splendid and super modern musical drama. Here's the New York Times. Although the material is horrifying, the workmanship is admirable.
The material is horrifying?
Well, you have a musical that has gang violence, an attempted rape, and murder. So it's heavy subject matter. Here's Hal Prince, the original producer.
The show did not, by the way, sell out for the year or so it ran on Broadway. It also had maybe 100 walkouts every single night. People totally confused by what it was and rejecting it.
But what really makes West Side Story the classic it is today is the movie from 1961. People all over were able to see it, and it ends up winning the Oscar for Best Picture. So West Side Story seems like this triumph for Latino representation. But today, as people look back at West Side Story, there are some negative critiques. Scholar and filmmaker Francis Negron Muntaner wrote a paper about it in 2000 that's like 100 pages long. She says, in a general sense, West Side Story is the Puerto Rican Birth of a Nation. You know that film?
Yeah. Birth of a Nation is famously the movie from 1915 where the KKK are portrayed as these American heroes at the expense of Black Americans. So she's making the argument that in the same way, people still admire Birth of a Nation for its, like, technical aspects, even though its race politics are terrible. People admire West Side Story for its technical aspects without thinking about, like, what the film means and how it portrays Puerto Ricans.
And it's funny because apparently Arthur Lawrence, who actually wrote West Side Story, hated the movie.
Really?
The movie, I thought and still think, was appalling. Film is either realistic or surreal. And a musical, to succeed, needs illusion. And then when the so-called Puerto Ricans came on, made up to look like Dayglo characters for some caricature of what they think Hispanics are, it was really disgraceful.
Well, that's really progressive of Arthur Lawrence.
Yeah.
Didn't they make Rita Moreno like two shades darker than she actually is?
They did. And they also put on these very fake, exaggerated accents.
I like to be in America. Okay, by me in America.
I watched the movie growing up, and it was one of the few American Latino things that I watched a lot. And I do agree that they're, like, essentially in brown face, and they have, like, really put-on accents. Like, there is a phoniness. But they were definitely not the enemies in the movie. Did the actors who portrayed the Puerto Rican characters in the play, were they Puerto Rican themselves? Do you know that?
Well, Chita Rivera played Anita in the original cast, right? The original Maria was Carol Lawrence.
So Maria, the lead, was played by a white girl.
Yeah, because the movie was Natalie Wood as well, who was a white actress.
Okay, so let's recap what we've learned thus far.
So far, we've got vaudeville and early Broadway with these really stereotypical ethnic caricatures. That takes us to 1957.
That was when West Side Story came out, which was this seminal musical that changed the game. It was like the first one to ever be about Latino lives in New York. But as we learned, it has its problems.
But Robert, the Broadway expert, argues despite all the problems it did have, it basically set the bar for telling stories beyond the white experience.
They talk a lot in the old days about the melting pot, that people from different cultures would come here and would all kind of melt together. But I think what they meant by that was that they would all kind of adopt an Anglo culture. And West Side Story was the first one that indicated that maybe that wasn't 100%. Maybe it was the Anglos who were going to be doing a little bit of the melting.
But we don't get a real American fondue for a little while longer, until this other play that I may be obsessed with comes along.
Dun, dun, dun!
Coming up on Latino USA, the original cast of In the Heights on Making the Musical. Stay with us, no te vayas.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security. More information is available online at carnegie.org. And Americans for the Arts, committed to transforming America's communities through the arts and arts education, supporting the nonprofit arts industry, which employs 4.6 million people nationwide. Learn more at AmericansfortheArts.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Before the break, we were talking about the history of Latinos on Broadway, from all the way back in the vaudeville days up until West Side Story in 1957. Ginny Montalvo and Antonia Cerejido pick up the history now.
So are there any musicals between West Side Story and In the Heights?
I married Alberto.
So in the next 50 years, we do see some Latino characters with a little depth, starting in Bye Bye Birdie in 1960.
I'll hide behind my fan and do the tango. I'll be so Spanish, it will make you sick.
Where we're now purposely going overboard on those stereotypes. Instead of laughing at stereotypes, we're going so over the top, you can, in a sense, laugh with us. It's more self-aware.
I'm so excited because I'm going to go to the High School of Performing Arts.
Then, in the 70s, we get A Chorus Line. A Chorus Line has the character Diana Morales, who is an actress who is the opposite of the characters we've seen up until now. Her being Puerto Rican is part of her identity, but there's nothing stereotypical about her.
Sleds in San Juan.
Then a few years after that, we have Evita. As an Argentine American, I assume that you know Evita. Am I right?
I've actually never seen Evita.
Oh my God! Why have you never seen Evita when it's about your people?
I think because it's too weird for me to, like, watch that part of history in a play or something. I know the song, obviously.
Don't cry for me, Argentina.
We need to have a musical marathon. Moving on. So that was 1979. Now we hit the 90s. There's a few musicals, but the biggest comes at the end of the decade. It's called The Cape Man.
I've been sleeping on the roof of my bed.
What's that?
The Cape Man I had never heard of.
Yeah, I had me neither.
So it was written by Paul Simon. The cast was like a who's who of salsa. Like, Marc Anthony was in it. Ruben Blades is in it.
I was born in Puerto Rico.
So let me read you the synopsis. It's based on the true story of Salvador Agron, who murdered two teenagers in the 1950s but turned his life around while in prison. It's very dark.
It's about
dark.
A Puerto Rican kid who murdered two people?
Yeah. But despite its all-star Latino cast and Paul Simon on the credits, it just didn't do well.
Hanging out with boys from Lexington and Park.
So we've moved away from being the punchline, right? And now we've got stories on stage, but we've got one about gang violence and we've got another one about a teenager who murdered two other teenagers.
Yeah, not the, like, prettiest image ever.
Exactly.
Until...
In the Heights.
Okay, so In the Heights is the brainchild of Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Heard of him.
Really? I don't know. Maybe you've heard of him because of a little musical called Hamilton. But we are here to tell you about the musical that he composed before Hamilton. Here's Lin-Manuel Miranda talking about the show in a PBS documentary called Chasing Broadway Dreams.
I started writing in the Heights my sophomore year at Wesleyan University. At first it was, I want to write the kind of musical I would want to be in. I also saw Rent, and it was the first time I'd seen a musical that took place now. And a light bulb really went off, and I was like, oh, you can write like a musical about you. About your life.
So for listeners, this is going to be a little bit of a spoiler if you haven't seen it. But In the Heights takes place in Washington Heights, in this neighborhood in upper Manhattan. And it's basically just takes place over the course of a weekend. It's July 4th, and it's about community, right? And Usnavi, the main character, owns a bodega with his cousin that he inherited from his parents. So the central conflict is he gets the chance to move to the Dominican Republic, and he's trying to figure out whether New York is home or the Dominican Republic is home.
Because I immigrated from the single greatest little place in the Caribbean, Dominican Republic. I love it. Jesus, I'm jealous of it.
Lin-Manuel's from New York. His background is Puerto Rican. So he's kind of like, he's coming from a space where he really knows.
Yeah, where he knows.
He knows what's up.
He gave a real name like Usnavi.
Yeah.
No white person. Writing a musical would have known to name a Hispanic character that.
Your father said, Usnavi, that's what we'll name the baby.
It really said U.S. Navy, but hey.
The set design is a corner in Washington Heights. The cast sings on the fire escapes. They're running in and out of the bodega and around the subway stop. And through the course of the weekend, somebody wins the lottery.
Somebody won!
96,000.
The blackouts in Manhattan happen.
Blackout.
The salon is closing, so it's like dealing with gentrification.
He's selling dispatch and they're closing the salon and they'll never turn the lights back on.
And Usnavi the whole time is kind of searching for where is home, which is like the first gen conundrum.
So how does In the Heights get made? How do they decide to greenlight it?
Well, it's very different from the 1950s in West Side Story, right? In this case, you don't have the creators reading about the community in the paper and writing their story. You have creators who actually lived it.
I remember getting a cassette tape of the show and popping it into my stereo, and the first thing that I heard was the sound of buckets, like the way you have street percussionists playing buckets. My name is Alex Lockamore, and for In the Heights, I was the original music director. I became the music supervisor, and I was the co-arranger and co-orchestrator with Bill Sherman. And I heard Lin-Manuel Miranda's voice rapping on top of it, and I thought it was just the coolest thing because, like, I love that he was mixing Spanglish into the stuff. It was something that was unlike anything that I had ever heard, and it really grabbed me.
So Alex Lockamore got a mixtape.
And at that point, Lin-Manuel was like a nobody, right?
I mean, you know, he's a kid fresh out of college, excited about this musical that he's been working on.
Mm-hmm.
But the material was so good that people were like, this is amazing. I have to do this, right?
One of these things that you really love about art is when you can see yourself in art, whether you see yourself represented on stage in a show, whether you hear about a story that deals with the family and that family has something that you feel like you can connect to. Like hearing a song where the title and the punchline was No Me Diga, which is something that I hear day in and day out in my daily life. It's not every day that you get to have a song on Broadway that has that kind of sentiment to it, that has that kind of connection. And all of a sudden you just hear something like that and you feel like they're speaking to just you. And it's like, oh my God, like they know me. How is that possible?
And for the cast, they told me that they'd never been part of a production like this.
I'm Robin DeJesus and I
played Sonny de la Vega in the show.
Yo, we're 96,000, I finally fixed housing.
My name is Mandy Gonzalez, and I played Nina Rosario in The Heights.
I used to think we lived at the
What is seemingly less romantic, but is most romantic to me about the thinking back about that experience was it was the first time where I wasn't the token Latino in the room.
Mm-hmm.
It was the first time where it was a piece about Latinos written by a Latino. And so there was an authenticity there that I had not experienced before. I didn't feel the need to be a dramaturg and be like, actually, we wouldn't say it that way.
Mm-hmm.
We wouldn't do that. There was no need for that.
And we were rooting each other on. Like, it wasn't like
yes.
we had to compete for the one role. We were all the roles.
100%.
And so that was different, and that felt good.
Mandy's character, Nina Rosario, questions what life would have been like if her parents had never left Puerto Rico.
Who would I be if I had never seen Manhattan, if I lived in Puerto Rico?
Her character is also the first to go away to college.
I got every scholarship, saved every dollar, the first to go to college.
So it's not just one Latino story. It's like you have all of these characters with individual issues.
I remember when we moved into the theater, usually the tradition with actors is we set up our dressing room for the beginning of the run, but we don't want to get too cozy because we don't know if the show's going to last or not.
Right.
So you wait a couple weeks to see how tickets are selling, how the reviews are.
You don't get any pillows.
You don't
maybe
buy
like
things.
A picture of your friends.
You pull back. I moved in. I came in with a truck. I was like, this show's going to run. I know it's going to happen. I got photos for days. I got a good mat. I got a good chair. I bought like a Pilates ball chair.
You did. I remember that.
I went in because I was like, no, we are here.
I am
claiming this land. We are colonizing it this time.
So wait, when did In the Heights open?
So the way Broadway works is usually you're off Broadway first for a few months, like the minor leagues, right? If you do well, you go to Broadway, the major leagues. In the Heights opens on Broadway in March of 2008.
We had two opening nights because there was off-Broadway opening night and then there was Broadway opening night.
And it's always a good party.
It's always
when Lynn
a
has
good
a party,
party,
it's always good.
What?
Because,
the
and
ancestors
also all of us,
show up.
Oh my goodness.
With Broadway opening nights, they can be really gloomy because the night that the show opens and you have the party is the same night the reviews come out and people head to their phones and
yeah.
start reading the review.
If they're not good, you see that the party stops. Like, people start to leave. You know, it's like a baseball game if, like, your home team isn't winning. Like, all of a sudden you're like, why is everybody going? Like, the music's still playing
mm-hmm.
and you're like, oh, the show's gonna close. Like, but this show, everybody partied until... Maybe.
One
so you knew we were, you know.
Living our
yeah,
lives.
We were going to be able to do it a little bit longer.
Yeah.
That's so cool. I didn't know that that's how the opening parties were.
And opening night was super emotional. Here's Alex, the musical director, again.
Up until that point, I had been working on the show for about 3 years straight, it feels like. And then we got to the finale. And then I don't know what came over me, but maybe I was just thinking about how much work had been put into it. And I had the best seat in the house. I'm conducting, playing piano. I'm looking up at Lynn, and he's right up in front of me rapping. And then he goes, and I could say goodbye to his smile and upon my island. I've been on it this whole time. I'm home. And then people started singing, the hydrants are open. I just started crying. I lost it. And I'm conducting at that point. I'm getting teary now thinking about it. But, and my hands were just waving and my head was down with tears just like flying out of my eyes.
Hear that music in the air, take the train to the top.
It's also nice seeing, I mean, we're comparing this story to West Side Story. Obviously, West Side Story is like very tragic ending.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, it's like very, it's a kind of cynical view of the Latino experience. And to see this completely different narrative in which the main character, you know, not only feels at home in America, but like is a depiction of what an American is. That's a huge change in the sort of portrayal on stage.
Yes, and Robert Viagas, the founder of Playbill.com, says that In the Heights was successful in a very American way.
We want something that's exciting, entertaining, tells a good story, etc., but also
something that is a financial success, something that sells him a lot of tickets, sells millions of dollars worth of tickets, wins a million awards. That's kind of that's what I mean by successful in an American way.
And it won 4 Tonys. One of those was Best Musical.
The 2008 Tony Award goes to In the Heights.
So you remember earlier when Robert was talking about the melting pot and how West Side Story started the trend that maybe Anglos should be doing the melting? He goes on to say that Lin really understood that.
He threw all those stereotypes away. He managed to get the melting pot to work in reverse. And I think that that ultimately is the great success of In the Heights.
It has a movie deal.
That's exciting.
That's, yeah.
And that's probably what's going to propagate it to be the West Side Story of our generation.
Exactly.
So in some ways you could say that In the Heights gets right what West Side Story got wrong.
Yeah, West Side Story put us on the stage. But In the Heights set a new bar about what a Latino story could be.
Hey! So Latinos, we've been on Broadway, we're gonna stay on Broadway, and I'm so thankful, Jeannie, that you brought us all of this amazing Latino history on Broadway.
De nada.
Our thanks to producers Jeannie Montalvo and Antonia Cerejido for that story. The In the Heights 10th Anniversary 3LP vinyl box set is now available from Ghostlight Records. And In the Heights creator Lin-Manuel Miranda has been a vocal advocate for Puerto Rico after it was devastated just a year ago by Hurricane Maria. The Category 5 storm wiped out a significant part of the island's infrastructure, including the electrical grid, which eventually led to the death of many more lives than authorities had originally reported. This is something that Latino USA and our sister podcast, In the Thick, has reported on extensively over the last year, ever since suspicions regarding the official death count began to emerge in the weeks after the hurricane. For an update on where Puerto Rico and the death count stand 1 year later, I'm joined now by my co-host on In the Thick, Julio Ricardo Varela. Julio, welcome back to Latino USA.
Hey, Maria.
All right, so almost 2 weeks after the hurricane made landfall, President Trump visited the island of Puerto Rico.
Every death is a horror. But if you look at a real catastrophe like Katrina, and you look at the tremendous hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people that died.
At the news conference, Trump sat down next to the governor of Puerto Rico, Ricardo Rosselló, and asked him,
what is your death count as of this moment? 17?
16 certified.
16 people certified. 16 people versus in the thousands. You can be very proud of all of your people, all of our people working together. 16 versus literally thousands of people.
So looking back, can you give us an update on where the death count stands today?
Right now, the government of Puerto Rico's official death count is 2,975 lost lives. That study commissioned by the government of Puerto Rico, they paid $300,000 for the Milken Institute of Public Health and GW to come up with a death count study, which basically looked at excess deaths from September of 2017 until the spring of 2018. And they basically said that looking at death certificates and looking at how they analyzed population growth and people leaving the island, that they were pretty sure an estimated 2,975 people had died, whether direct conditions or indirect conditions of Hurricane Maria.
So basically the report was saying that there were people who were permanently affected and their deaths may have happened months later, but it was all because of Hurricane Maria.
Right. It's like loss of power, not having access to medical care, not having access to food, water, so many conditions, you know, roads being closed. There were so many stories that were coming out in September of 2017, October of 2017, and November, people saying, like, my relative died because of an effect from the hurricane. And that actually led the governor of Puerto Rico to say, we need to now do a death toll study that would look into who are the people, how did they die? And in the meantime, Maria, the Center for Investigative Journalism, the Associated Press, and Quartz last week just came out with a list of about 500 names of actual stories that they received through an online submission from people. And they tied those names to death certificates. So what we know now is that there are names to some of these victims.
There's a lot of confusion around what the U.S. government did or didn't do, what FEMA did or didn't do. The U.S. GAO, the Government Accountability Office, released a report saying that FEMA had been overwhelmed with storms just when Hurricane Maria was hitting Puerto Rico a year ago.
Yeah, you got to put it in the context of Hurricane Harvey happening in Texas, Hurricane Irma happening in Florida. Now, this report by FEMA and also by the General Accounting Office uses a lot of government speak to get to the reality that the federal response was never as strong or as quick as it should have been. And there were warnings. There were early indications.
And then this month, Trump made the following statement.
I think that Puerto Rico was an incredible unsung success. Texas, we have been given A pluses for. Florida, we've been given A pluses for. I think in a certain way, the best job we did was Puerto Rico, but nobody would understand that. I mean, that's
and there seems to be another disconnect, which is what is the role of Puerto Rico's governor? You know, he was there at that first meeting when Trump said these numbers are so small and this isn't a real tragedy. How has the Puerto Rican governor been responding to all of this?
The moment Rosselló said that in October, and I've went on record saying that that was his biggest political mistake. There was a lot going on at the time, and it was pretty clear that the death count was not 16. And the fact that you had the governor of Puerto Rico kind of just say 16 certified deaths, as opposed to saying, Mr. President, let's not diminish this tragedy. I think this would have changed this immediately and how he's been perceived, because that was a huge political error. And to credit Rosselló, he's kind of admitted it, but he's admitted it like a year later. So if you see what he's been doing since Trump has been talking about being successful and also about the death count, Rosselló is now trying to fight back. I do think it's a little bit too late.
So what comes next in terms of the death count? I mean, obviously, this story is still very much in the national conversation.
Well, there's a couple of things. Like, there's supposedly this plan to start creating what they call visual autopsies, basically meaning it's in a phase two of the study. Researchers would go down to the island and begin to look at, you know, match death certificates, find the families and actually start interviewing them so that you can get a better sense of what were the causes. Were these really impacted by the hurricane? So there's still a lot of research and work. It's very unclear what the government of Puerto Rico is going to do with the data. So I do wonder whether Puerto Rico has woken up and is coming to terms with this tragedy. Governor Rosselló wants to kind of to move along. You know, we've done the study, let's move on. But I also think there's too many tragedies out there, too many untold stories. I don't think Puerto Ricans are ready to put this to rest. And so I do think there's still going to be a lot of grappling and a lot of soul searching over the next couple of months, Maria. This story's not going away.
Julio, thanks again so much for speaking with us on Latino USA.
Thanks again, Maria.
Julio Ricardo Varela is my co-host of Latino USA's sister show, In the Thick. It's a POC-focused political podcast. You can check out In the Thick's special on the one-year anniversary of Hurricane Maria wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up on Latino USA, the Flores brothers were amongst the most prominent drug traffickers in the world until they became FBI informants. Today, we hear from their wives. Stay with us. No te vayas.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Rockefeller Foundation, promoting the well-being of humanity throughout the world since 1913. More about Rockefeller's work in food, health, power, jobs, and resilient cities at rockfound.org. And the Kauffman Foundation, working together with communities in education and entrepreneurship to create uncommon solutions and empower people to shape their lives and be more successful. More online at kauffman.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
He has been named public enemy number one by a U.S. crime-fighting group, but now El Chapo is in police custody.
Joaquin El Chapo Guzman is known around the world as the now imprisoned leader of Mexico's Sinaloa cartel, described by the U.S. Justice Department as, quote, one of the most prolific, violent, and powerful drug cartels ever. He's perhaps the largest looming figure in Mexico's drug war, which is estimated to have caused the deaths of over 100,000 mostly innocent people. El Chapo was arrested in 2014 after evading law enforcement for over a decade. Then he escaped prison, and he was arrested again in 2016. He's being held in the United States awaiting trial. But it's the earlier arrest in 2014 that we're going to focus on right now.
Inside the takedown of El Chapo, the notorious drug lord, responsible for a quarter of the drugs coming to the U.S.
The reason El Chapo was caught in 2014 wasn't because of a slip-up. It was because two of his top men decided to turn on him. Pedro and Junior Flores are twin brothers who grew up in Little Village, a predominantly Mexican neighborhood in Chicago. They became key figures in the international drug trafficking world by the time they were 22. They met El Chapo in 2005 after they had fled to Mexico from a U.S. drug indictment. Shortly afterwards, they were running a North American drug ring worth nearly $2 billion.
The brothers rose from being local street drug dealers in the Windy City to running Joaquin El Chapo Guzman's drug empire in the U.S.
Using the Flores brothers' U.S. connections, the Sinaloa cartel is said to have supplied 80% of Chicago's street drugs. At the height of their business, the brothers were living luxurious lives in Mexican mansions with their wives and children. But after a bloody cartel war broke out, the Flores brothers were caught in the middle, and they feared for their lives. They fled north, returning to the United States to seek the help of law enforcement as a way to get themselves and their families out of Mexico safely. But in order to do that, they agreed to become informants.
Cooperation starting secretly in 2008, 70 recorded conversations, two with El Chapo himself, they say. U.S. authorities saying these are extraordinary witnesses.
The Flores brothers are currently serving a 14-year reduced federal sentence and are set to be star witnesses in El Chapo's New York trial this fall. But behind this sensational capture and trial are real people and a family. The wives of the brothers, Mia and Olivia Flores, recently released a book about what it's like to be married to two of the world's biggest drug dealers and to have a hit out on your family. The names Mia and Olivia, by the way, are aliases that the two women use in their book in order to protect their identities. And they also requested that we alter their voices for their own protection. They join me now to tell me their stories. Let's go back to your little girls growing up in Chicago. Both of your dads are Chicago police officers.
Yes.
You're the daughter of a police officer. Mm-hmm. And you're feeling like, oh, my God, I really love this guy. He's adorable. He's so cute. But, oh, my God, I know that there's, like, some bad stuff going on here. Mia, let's start with you.
I grew up in the south side of Chicago. So I grew up in a blue-collar, you know, it was everybody in that neighborhood was striving for the same thing. And it was ironic when my husband and his family moved in. He had his flashy cars out in front and he had his jewelry. And it was just, you know, something that I never seen growing up in that neighborhood. You know, I went to Catholic schools. I, you know, tried to do everything right by my parents. And what's ironic about the story is that my father knew of the Flores brothers. And actually, I brought them to just a block party in Chicago. He noticed that, though, those are the twins that were from Little Village. And he told that he did not want me around them. He said that they were bad news. He didn't even want me to be friends with them.
And for you, Olivia, your life as a little girl was pretty sweet, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, it was very normal. I came from a great family. My parents were law-abiding citizens, private school. I mean, we had braces when nobody else had braces. They tried to do everything for us. So I think that my parents were very strict when I was growing up, and I didn't want to follow the rules. It wasn't fun. My house was boring, and I just wanted to do what I wanted to do. And I became very rebellious. I was very attracted to the bad boys. And I think because it felt like it was a rush. And so when I fell in love with these bad boys, of course, they were involved in the drug trade. And I started becoming addicted to that lifestyle where I thought that money was everything. I loved fancy cars and flashy jewelry and spinning rims and all that. And so it was like appealing to me, and I wanted it for myself.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of people don't realize that this is actually going on in the United States. So how did your husbands get involved in the trafficking world to begin with? I mean, how do you start off here?
Well, I think that when I met my husband, he already was in the drug trade just because, he was born into it. His father was, he was involved with the cartel, and he was trafficking drugs, his whole life. And, he started teaching our husbands at a very young age, like, how this works. Like, they were sticking their little hands in the gas tanks and pulling out his drugs for him. They were, counting his money for him. They had to learn their multiplication just to count their money. They were translating, from Spanish to English, drug deals that were happening for their dad. They would go across the border to Mexico and bring his drugs back with him. And they're 7, 8, 9 years old. It was very disturbing. They were they didn't have a normal childhood. My father-in-law would tell them that this is how it works and this is how you feed your family.
So it was never like, hey, you see that guy on the corner who is slumped over because he did too much heroin. They would never say, like, that's because of what we're doing. That there was never the connection of, like...
No, and it takes somebody like our husbands to wake up and be like, this is wrong, what we're doing. We're going to denounce this life. And not only are we going to do that, we're going to put a dent in the drug trade, and we're going to take down Chapo Guzman, who is the biggest narco trafficker. He's the biggest narco terrorist in the world.
So... Mia, can you get that somebody might hear that and just be like, yeah, but your husband was a part of it?
I mean, I wish I can sit here and rationalize and tell you otherwise, but we understand the devastation. And us as mothers and parents, we wouldn't want that for our own children. We wouldn't want it for anyone else's children, for that matter. You know, when you're in that world, when you're in that, you're living that lifestyle, everything, you just become blind to everything else.
So I'm sure that there are people who are going to hear this and they're going to be like, you weren't just kind of turning a blind eye or maybe not knowing. There are probably people who are going to say, you guys were complicit.
In our defense, me and I sat there and we constantly were in our husband's ears to change their life. I don't think they would have if it wasn't for us, because they felt like, you know what, they loved us enough. They felt like we were worth it. They loved their children and they felt like their children were worth it, that they will sacrifice themselves and they will turn themselves in and go to prison for 14 years. And this is just not about the prison sentence. This is a death sentence for us. I mean, we have to walk around with wigs and sunglasses and we have to hide from the world.
You've got bodyguards, right? I mean,
we have armed bodyguards with us.
Like, who are these guys? There are two guys that came in with you guys today, right?
And an armed driver outside. Yes, they're here to protect us, to make sure that nobody's going to harm us, because we have bounties on us. There's people out there with contracts, and they're trying to kill us just because our husbands are cooperating against Chapo Guzman. That's never going to go away.
How have you made peace with that part of your lives? How do you guys live?
We live in fear, but we try to give our children normalcy. We try to give them a normal life. Our children are very much in a bubble. My children don't even know their father's real name just because I don't want them to Google him.
Why become cooperators?
It just frees you from everything. It makes you see life in a different perspective. I see our future and I see a bright future for all of us.
I mean, I went to prison because I did not snitch. I mean, I had that mentality that you don't tell, you don't snitch, you don't rat because you don't respect someone that does. I mean, my first husband, he cooperated and I didn't respect him. I divorced him because of it. But when you have somebody that you know that is worth everything in your life and you see the good in them, I didn't care. That whole street mentality was out the window. I am so proud of him that I don't mind getting on television and saying that my husband's a cooperator. I think he's the bravest man in my eyes.
It's not over for the four of you. How many more years before your husbands get out?
Our husband's been there for 10 years, and they have another 2.5 years left. I don't think that me and I could have gotten through this without each other. I mean, we have to, honestly, it's sad, but we have to live this lie. You know, we can't tell people who we are. We can't tell people where we came from. We can't share our life with anyone. Me and I only have each other.
Your husbands are going to have to testify against Chapo Guzman.
Yes.
So are you guys...
We're devastated.
Are you waiting to see that witness list at any moment?
Yes, we are.
Yes, we're very worried. They say this trial is going to be bigger than the O.J. Simpson trial, so we can only imagine that our lives are going to be turned upside down. Very soon we'll be going into the witness protection program when this trial arises, so this is our only option.
Me and Olivia Flores are the authors of the book Cartel Wives. El Chapo's trial in Brooklyn, New York is scheduled to begin this November. That's it for today. Latino USA is produced by Miguel Macias, Antonia Cerejido, Andres Caballero, Maggie Freeling, Janice Yamoka, and Sayer Quevedo, with help from Fernanda Chavarri. We're edited by Marlon Bishop and Sofia Paliza Carr. Our engineers are Jeannie Montalvo and Stephanie LeBeau. Our production manager is Natalia Fidelholz. Our fellows are Virginia Lora and Jesse Alejandro Cottrell. Our intern is Paula Moura. Special thanks to Jeff London of the NPR series 50 Years of West Side Story. The Leonard Bernstein clip was from the Dramatists Guild, and the Arthur Lawrence clip is from an NPR story by Tom Manoff. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. If you like the music you heard on this episode, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on our next episode. And in the meantime, you can find us on all of your social media. Hasta la próxima. Ciao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. The Annie E. Casey Foundation creates a brighter future for the nation's children by strengthening families, building greater economic opportunity, and transforming communities. And funding for Latino USA's coverage of A Culture of Health is made possible in part by a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
Once more with feeling.
La, la, la.
You're not even on the same key.
I know. I can't.
Give me jazz fingers.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. And the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. This is NPR.